Congratulations.
You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture and coffee podcast.
No, not really.
Percolations are very audible.
Listen, Mercury is in retrograde. We got to have some coffee retrograde. Let's not
say what now.
What? Yeah.
With Kate Rhodes.
And me, Maysoon Wazwaz. Thanks for listening.
Right off the bat, thanks for listening. Okay, a lot of things, just some basic housekeeping we got to do right now. Number one, our podcast goes out on this service called FeedBurner that Google provides to people for free, and it's just what you use if you don't know any other way to put out a podcast. Bad news, Google might be canceling FeedBurner. So if ever, listen to me, listeners, listen. If ever you go to your iTunes and the podcast is supposed to be out that day, but for whatever reason it's not, go to the website, congratulationspinetree.com, and maybe we'll have to have moved things somewhere, okay?
Isn't it .blogspot.com?
If you go to congratulationspinetree.com, it forwards you. So here's the deal. This is the contingency plan. Just go to the website. If something's wrong, just go to the website. Right now, we don't have any plans to be moving anything anywhere, so everything should still be working just as usual. But just in case, because I have a friend who knows someone at Google, and they said that they might be dropping it.
Kate's freaking out. We'll put an emergency plan on the website.
Yeah.
So just go to the website.
If anything's wrong, just go to the website. Congratulationspinetree.com.
Actually, you should just save this episode on your iPod or your iPhone or your computer or whatever. And so if that were to happen, you could just reference this website, this particular episode again.
Well, really, you should just be checking the website every 15 minutes.
Don't do that, listeners.
Another thing that's coming up is on March 8th, the SEIU, which is the Service Employees International Union. Is that right? I could be wrong on that. Anyhow, that is who is unionizing the adjunct professors. A lot of the art professors at SFAI, CCA, and Mills all have been unionizing, and that's their union, is the SEIU. They're having an event at the lab on March 8th. It's going to be kind of a fair to come learn about these things, support the union, learn about other labor and activist organizations, have some food, see some weird shit happen. I think Keith Hennessy is hosting it.
Great.
And Congratulations Pine Tree is going to be there. So if for no other reason, come and see us and give us some side hugs.
Side hugs.
That is on March 8th.
So will they be talking about the process of making the adjunct? Or
there's going to be tables and also presentations. So
okay, good.
If there's not a presentation for them, there's probably going to be people there you can just talk to about it.
Yeah. I'd like to hear more about that. Even though I work at Mills, it hasn't been very publicized, obviously.
I think there's some stress between
the faculty and the administration around that.
I know at CCA, or I can't remember if it was CCA or SFAI, so I'm sure I'm slandering one of them, but there was some intimidation happening. Oh, maybe it was,
I think it was SFAI.
At Berkeley, too, when the grad students were striking. There was intimidation for sure. Anyhow, I mentioned in the last episode that on February 25th, there's going to be an adjunct walkout. And I think Mills is not participating in that walkout, but they are going to have a day of like labor education. So like an event to at least recognize that all this stuff is happening. So that'll be on the quad.
There's definitely some stuff going down at Mills right now regarding the adjunct, the new union there. I know they recently hired an outside financial analyst to look at the schools.
Oh yeah, they're doing that at the finances other schools too. Yeah,
because I think there's been some discrepancy over faculty pay and whether or not they're getting, you know, appropriate increases or raises. So I'm curious to see what the outcome of that.
Great.
Those conversations are.
Yeah, that's important.
And also how that impacts the kind of the faculty and also the entire school, you know, staff and everyone else that's there.
Oh yeah. Fuck yeah, man.
I'm all for unions, people. Let's just be real.
Boots Riley, very, very serious labor organizer, supporter.
Indeed. Indeed.
Not just unions, but when Boots Riley talks about it, he's like, not just unions, but maybe we need to imagine also other groups of people that organize to, you know, be the beneficiaries of their own labor.
Mm-hmm. Mills
Thrills College.
There's a collaboration between the art museum and the art department. We just started a semester long artist in residence program called API, or Art Process Ideas. There's three artists, two are local, one is from LA, that
Zaruhi.
Zaruhi Abdalian, Jacqueline Kayomi Gordon, and Weston Teruya. Super excited about all of them, but they'll be working in the studios in the art department for the semester. And in the summer, the work that they've produced and during the studios or during the residency will culminate in a show at the museum, which will be cool.
How's that going?
It's going good awesome. So far. Yeah, it's great. Weston is there all the time. We see his green little green truck. So cool. And Zaruhi's actually there they're all there quite a bit. But yeah, there'll be open houses.
That's got to be intense for them, man. Having all the psychotic MFAs running around, buzzing around their faces.
We're like being very protective of them. We're like, MFAs, calm down. No, they're good.
Yep.
MFAs will have an opportunity to meet with the artists. They'll do studio visits and stuff with them.
It's hard to miss them if you're in the same building.
There's only one who's in the same building.
It's people screeching, screaming, flailing their arms out the window.
They're a little more mellow than maybe your class was.
Oh, I know these people. I was in school with them.
No, you weren't.
Yeah. The second years were first years.
The second years are definitely chilled out.
I've heard stories.
Anywho.
I've seen stories unfold before my eyes.
There's more information about the artists on our website.
Stories that would shock and amaze.
mcam.mills.edu.
We're here at Stephen Wolf Fine Arts Gallery in San Francisco, California, talking to the man himself, Stephen Wolf. Part of the reason that we wanted to talk to you is because we heard that the gallery was closing, which we both felt was very sad.
Why I'm closing the gallery, I guess, is the most, you know, newsworthy question. And it's actually probably, my answer is going to be a bit of a surprise, because I'm not closing it because, I am losing my space. Mm-hmm. But it's not that hard to find a commercial space in San Francisco, an affordable commercial space to operate out of. I mean, and quite frankly, the space is the least central thing to a gallery at this point. I mean, a number of spaces that I think people would say are doing well in San Francisco now operate out of like tiny, informal spaces that you would not say are like the reason why people go to that gallery. Mm-hmm. So losing the space is really not the big issue. For me, honestly, it was more personal. I've been doing this business in some form since like 1999, maybe even to a certain extent before that. And I'm a little bit bored, even though my programming is an adventure. And I still like to do it. Running a gallery is primarily merchandising and searching for patrons. You work in a museum, you know what that's like. You constantly have to deliver people with money to a board that donates to the gallery. It's basically the same thing here, I mean, except I'm trading artwork for that money. And it's tiring, and it's not a good fit for me from an employment standpoint. It doesn't play to my strengths. And I certainly don't enjoy it the way some people are like, you know, Larry Gagosian gets up in the morning and makes 50 cold calls every day. It's really like you have to have a kind of inner strength to do that. And you have to not care. You have to like just like relish like what comes from that. And of course, if you get a cold call from Larry Gagosian, today it's like getting a celebrity call. So it's like people take your call. But when he started, it probably wasn't that way. It was probably a hassle to get important people to return his call. But I'm not doing that. I'm not cold calling 50 people a day. But that's really how you go about, you know, making it. It's like you have to be a force of nature. And for reasons that are entirely personal, I don't want to do that work. And so somebody in the gallery has to do that work. And it's, you know, it has generally falls to the owner. So that's really like, it's really very personal, number one. I just don't really want to do this work anymore. And it's, you know, I've been working on behalf of a lot of people for a long time, trying to, you know, represent their work. And it's been fun. It's fun to design exhibitions. It's fun to present them. But I also don't like going to the parties. It's like, I don't like going to my own parties. And when the calendar date rolls around every 6 weeks, I feel like, you know, this is going to be, this is like the least fun part of my.
And is it because you feel like you have to schmooze like crazy in order to try to sell work? Or, you know, because it's the parties are often artists, your artists, and then their friends, and then people who are just supporters of yours. Does it feel, is it the schmoozing thing that you hate at the parties?
That's my reason.
Yeah, well, it's like you're really, what you're trying to do is you're trying to create a situation in which interesting people are in a room together. And so some of the most interesting events have been where people, say, from the kind of punk prankster era of San Francisco, the early 80s maybe, were in a room with people who sort of got their MFAs at the Art Institute in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And they're just two populations that, you know, were not at odds, but just with totally different expectations and sensibilities. And watching them interact was always the most, that was the most interesting situation. That also, those parties also have to be, you also have to supply, to really have good collectors, you really have to supply a kind of social entertainment component. Like, you have to be able to deliver, you know, famous artists for them to meet and hang out with, and you have to provide the backdrop for it, you know, fancy dinners, like something that's going to really make them feel like this is, they're part of something. And I just don't, I'm not really a host in that sense of the word. I mean, I'm doing an event on Wednesday in which I'm getting in the same room, I'm getting William T. Volman, the novelist, with Genesis Peorage, the, you know, sort of pioneer of industrial music and pop star. And to my mind, that will be a fascinating, it's like the energy, like, I don't, no one's ever done this, obviously. They're just two people who don't, have never been in the same room together. So it's a first. I can do that kind of thing, but, like, you know, having, like, creating the whole, like, oh, I'm going to have a dinner in the gallery with, like, the collectors will come and they'll meet the artist. And, like, I'm just not that person. I'm also, it's also, I feel like I would like to escape the name of the gallery, and I would like to escape the gallery's history. Like, I teach at SFAI, and I often, like, encourage my students to, like, you know, think in terms of self-invention when it comes to their work. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe it's time to invent a character to produce a new body of work so that you get off, you know, feeling this need to be authentic and to produce out of your, you know, the way you've been producing and to build on what you've been doing. Mm-hmm. And this will be the opportunity for me to treat the next project as, you know, something that perhaps comes from like an invented place, as opposed, invented authorship, as opposed to like this thing that had my name on it, yeah, that had a deliberately old fashioned name because, you know, I was dealing in contemporary art. Mm-hmm. And I thought that would be funny, but no one ever really got the joke. And I'll be able to, like, essentially rewrite the rules for myself. I will continue to work as a private dealer. So that's really how I make most of my money anyway. I'll sell. I've had a lot of success selling the works by people like Wallace Berman and Richard Pettibone and Andy Warhol and people like that.
Can I ask a stupid question? How does being a private dealer work? Just because I've obviously, because I'm involved with the art world, I've heard of that before, but I never really understood how that works. Is like, I know when artists talk about, oh, well, my dealer is working on whatever, selling this piece for me, I always think that that's their gallerist.
Yeah.
So then how does being a dealer without a gallery work?
Well, I've been doing this for a while, so I know both collectors and other dealers, and I sell, I sell artwork with some of the same people I've been doing it with for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm very comfortable doing it that way because I wouldn't need a contract. I know these people for a long time. We've made each other money for a long time. And it's been very, you know, it's just a business of, you know, this is a business of predators and of people who don't know what they're doing and who have bad taste and who are unreliable in so many ways. And so when you actually meet up with and bond with people who are reliable, sharp, honest, mm-hmm. and know what they're doing, you try to stay in business with them. And so I know a bunch of people like that, although I haven't been very aggressive about reaching out. You know, I mean, I could very easily. So I know those people, and I know where a lot of things are. Like, I know where collections are, and I know where the stuff is, and I know how to find the stuff of different kinds. And so I basically just keep putting these things together and keep making deals. Someone says, like, oh, I want a Jean-Michel Basquiat drawing for my friend. And then I find one and we sell one. And, you know, you sell it for $100,000 and you make $10,000. So it's just that simple. You have to find the thing that they want, and you have to be able to know it's real. You have to know, you know, first of all, you have to know what's good, what's not good, what a person might want, what they won't want. Then you have to know how to identify it, how to find it, how to make sure it's real. There are a lot of liabilities. I mean, there's tons of fakes in the world. So going through that process is tricky. I stick with what I know, and I learn, I sort of increase what I know slowly and carefully.
I've known you to be a frequenter at the flea market.
I can make a, actually, I could go to the flea market on Sundays and make a near six-figure living by just doing it. There's so much money to be made there.
Whoa.
It's crazy.
Kate. Jesus Christ.
I found one thing in 2011 or 12 I researched and found out is now referred to as the most important rock and roll poster. And it's like 20 by 10 billboard size poster by Robert Fried, who was a psychedelic poster artist and very interesting artist who taught at SFAI for years and died very young. And this is a fascinating piece of work. And I found that there for $100. And the only other one for sale is for $1 million. It's not worth $1 million. Yeah. It's probably worth, you know, what, $80,000, $150,000, $250,000, whatever you can make of it, really. It's like an incredible object. And that's happened to me a number of times where I've hit
amazing
stuff like that.
That's wild.
But I also, you know, I mean, I just buy, like, I was buying Richard Pettibone paintings in the 90s, and the first one I bought was at what was then Butterfields and Butterfields, which is now Bonhams, and it was $150. And one of the last ones I sold was $150,000. So just being in the right place at the right time and watching the art world slowly, and in buying the right stuff and watching the art world slowly, you know, go up. It's not that hard, actually, to be an art investor.
How'd you ever get into art to begin with?
In my 20s, I was a newspaper reporter, and my focus was, like, on politics and crime. And I occasionally wrote about theater, which I was interested in. I was trying to write plays at that time. And then I lived in New York and then in L.A. So I was in Hollywood. And when I met my wife, when I was living in Paris. And she wanted to do her Ph.D. at Stanford, so we came here. And I didn't have anything to do for a while. Sort of, I had decided I didn't really want to continue working in as a reporter because I was good at it. I'm a good writer, but it seemed like it was really hard to make money doing it. At the time, this is like the late 80s, early 90s, newspapers were closing. The internet hadn't arrived as an alternative way to deliver content, and so there weren't any of those jobs yet. It was just a really, like, grim, like, this is the end. Like, it's TV news, TV cable news, or nothing. And I didn't see myself being a good fit for TV news. We came to San Francisco. I really had nothing to do. I was writing theater reviews for Backstage magazine in New York. And we lived in the Mission, like a couple of blocks from Valencia Street, and I just started wandering around going to, like, the junk stores there. You know, I started just stumbling through these places with zero knowledge of the the local art scene, I started finding amazing things that like I was able to quickly research and figure out, like, hey, this, I never heard of Nathan Oliveira, but he's an important local artist and people seem to pay these things. And I found an important early painting of his, collage actually. And so it literally started that way. And I liked the idea that I was starting something at the very bottom, because art dealing, I never would have wanted to, like, I'm going to start a gallery and I'm going to get all these artists together and I'm going to like get a space and put the money together and like run this enterprise and see what happens. It's like, I actually built it, partly as a conceptual, you know, thing, like, oh, let's see if I can do this business just picking stuff up off the streets, basically. Like, it's so antithetical to your idea of how an art business would work. It's like the complete opposite. Although there was a TV show called Lovejoy, BBC show from like the 70s or 80s, and it was about an, like a completely criminal and enterprising like art and antiques dealer who just like went through like countrysides swindling locals out of their stuff, and I really like grifting essentially, and I really liked that idea. I don't have a criminal personality, so I'm not going to be a grifter, but if I could perform one in some half-hearted way, I thought it would be fun. And
you could create a character in your next venture and be a grifter.
Well, I sort of created my own character to be who I am now. It's not terribly authentic. And so it always felt like part performance anyway. And so I started making money very quickly doing that and teaching myself the history of art, particularly from California, because there was no gallery system from the late 19th century till really the 70s and 80s when galleries started cropping up in meaningful numbers. So artists had no way to distribute their works, and they often just got lost or fell in the cracks or went through these unauthorized channels. And so all you essentially had to do was keep a lookout for where stuff showed up, and they would show up. Warehouse auctions, dumpsters, thrift stores, the flea market. Then I would, you know, expanded it to include estate sales. And then I started like tracking down the artists. And so that was fun for a while because many of them had died and their widows were the ones, you know, were still around. And so I don't know if you've ever seen the Mel Brooks film, The Producers.
Yep.
All those early scenes with Zero Mostel romancing the old ladies to get their money to pay for the productions. I'm going to say there was an element of that. That was the only way I could get to their cooperation. It wasn't like I was trying to, you know, swindle them in any way. I just needed to charm them into cooperating with me to let me sell the work. And everything, it was always like to the betterment of whatever they were doing. I mean, I was actually constructing markets for a lot of these artists who never had them or hadn't had them for decades, you know, or who always had to rely on their own, you know, seat of their pants to sell their work. So it expanded and basically grew into a more normal curatorial practice. But my eye was developed in a very particular way. So I had to pick the thing that was going to have value out of like a tableau of essentially trash. And so the thing had to be able to broadcast its value or worthwhileness, like without any marketing. It just had to stand out that way. And I developed a kind of eye for those objects that really felt like they had, in a very intuitive sense and in a very like visual, weird visual detective sense, the like how to pick objects like that that could stand up for themselves over time. You know, so yeah. In that sense, my training has outsmarted itself. I'm sometimes asking more from an object than everybody else is, and therefore I miss out on like what the thing is that I should be working with that's going to make money.
You wouldn't care to give an example of any of these unworthy objects?
No, I don't like...
Don't want to call anybody out?
Yeah. No. Let me see if I can find...
Or maybe one. Just a like a trope like...
Well, here, I'll give you... I mean, I don't want to... I don't want to make anybody feel bad, and I'm not going to name anybody, but there was a craze for making paintings with irradiating bands of color in San Francisco. And what had happened was Alicia McCarthy came up with a very interesting visual style, visual, and, you know, totally, like, I like Alicia McCarthy's paintings. And they were so good that everybody else started making Alicia McCarthy paintings. And then all the collectors started buying these paintings that were, you know, based on Alicia McCarthy paintings, way too many of them. And I always thought, like, well, those are, you know, lesser versions of Alicia McCarthy paintings. Like, why would you want to, you know, show those? Mm-hmm. But they, a lot of them sold, and I didn't sell a single one. So that's a perfect example of, like, a total craze that, you know, came through that, you know, did really well and I didn't participate in.
The narrative of the Bay Area lately is all about, like, you know, the crazy out of control wealth forcing places to shut down, and that you kind of are deciding to do this to close your gallery space. I just wonder if, I don't know, just your general feeling about the Bay Area in this current moment, I guess.
Well, you know, the Bay Area is evolving, like a lot of, it's becoming hyper-monetized, like all other successful cities. The economy of the art world, the way that's evolving, is way more, like, significant to running a gallery than, like, the local environment. Yeah, it's like, if your rent is $600, as some galleries in San Francisco still are, it hardly matters. Like, but it's what you're really dealing with is a 99% 1% world. So if you can sell stuff to the people in the 1%, you're going to do okay. If you have to worry about selling stuff to the 99%, and that includes a lot of lawyers, and, you know, you're still in, it's still a challenge. So, how you actually circulate art outside of San Francisco is more important than how you circulate it inside of San Francisco. And if you want to be, like, a success circulating art in San Francisco, you almost have to be a success outside first. You will not get like important art consultants and important collectors to pay attention to you if you are a San Francisco gallery with a San Francisco background. If they see you at Basel in Switzerland, if they see you in Miami at the Wright Fair, if they see you in these different places, and other people are buying stuff from you in these places, then they will, they'll start to circle around. So it's more important that you figure out how to work through the art fair system, which is a whole other, like, situation, and that you know how to merchandise yourself on a global scale, then, or at least a national scale or a slightly international scale, than anything that's happening in the Bay Area. I have almost no clients in the Bay Area. I have very few. We export most of the contemporary art I've ever sold. I've exported to people in some form whatsoever. So, you know, it's like, yeah, there are rich people everywhere. And there are very few wealthy people who are collecting, like, what's going on here. You know, one of the things that I've done is I've tried to create, like, a kind of, like, narrative of underground avant-garde stuff from the 40s through, like, today, or at least till the end, what you could call the end of the underground, like the 80s, let's say, for lack of a better term, just to keep it artificial and simple. There just aren't that many people collecting that stuff, and it's not like, you know, like everybody from Google is going to get on board with the idea that that's cool. Mm-hmm. The people who collect that stuff for me are quirky. A finance person in the medical industry, you know, a businessman here and there. They're just quirky people who have enough money to keep buying that stuff. So it's also more an issue of fashion. Like, you... marketing art is like marketing, like, couture, you know, and if you're good at that, if you're good at figuring out how to do that, people will find you. But Bay Area people will find you after people from other places will find you. New Yorkers, for instance, are much more aggressive about looking for stuff than people here are.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah. You're staying here?
Yes, I live here. My kid goes to school here. My wife lives here with me. We all live here, in fact, four blocks away. So that's the biggest disappointment, is that whatever my next space is, my commute will be longer.
Congratulations. We've got to redact everything.
We evict more people than LA.
Do we?
Yep.
You don't know that.
We sure do.
You sure don't know that.
We sure do.
You sure don't know it.
I sure know.
Okay, I'm just going to tell this story because I can't think of anything else to talk about. I was at a thing once.
Okay. And let's call him.
Was this an art event?
Let's call him Jerome. I was at a certain event. That event happened to have a lot of things I was unfamiliar with and that were a little extreme for me for an art thing. It was a very extreme show. And after the show, I was like, in my mind, I was like, what the fuck did I just watch?
Was it an exhibition or an event, performance, series of performances?
I don't even know if I want to give that much detail.
I need more information.
It was a performance.
Okay.
And sure enough, I see someone who's kind of a important person who I had just met the day before through a class.
Okay.
Won't say any more about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I approach this person. The person is giving me every social cue that I should not approach them. Okay. They're like checking their phone. They're like avoiding eye contact. And my friend is with me. And my friend, who I thought was walking with me, stops about 20 feet away from this person. But I do not know that. Okay. So I continue right up to this person. No idea why. I mean, I was high off the insanity of this performance, okay?
But you just met this person the
day before. I had just met them the day before, and I was like, oh, you know, no big deal.
I'm just going to go say hi.
Just go talk to them. And so I walk up to the person. I'm like, hey, I know you from this. I met you this time. And they're like, okay. And I was like, what the fuck did we just watch? I asked them.
Oh, well, you know, that might be part of the problem. Not everyone is going to respond to you in the same way.
But we were both just sitting at this performance. And let me tell you, this performance had
nudity.
It had spitting on the audience. It had fucking people looking like they were fucking each other. Mm. I'm serious. Like, this was not like the ballet. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Swearing. They were swearing in the show. I don't know. Anyhow, so the person was just like, so I'm like, what the fuck was that? And the person was like, performance art.
Mm-hmm.
End of conversation. I have never
talked. Was this at Counterpulse?
I've never talked to them again.
Well, why is that? What's the big deal about that?
I don't know, because I just felt like such a dildo.
Well, that sounds like it's more about you than about that person.
So you think
maybe.
It's all good and we can be best friends again and I should probably talk to them now every time I see them?
I don't think that person is the most like warm and cuddly.
Okay.
I mean, I think he's probably a very nice person.
Don't say he. I never said the gender.
You said Jerome.
I do feel like I have a lot more rapport with women and just in general.
Women are more forgiving.
So anyhow, let's go ahead and come back to this on the next episode. What if we start doing like Serial and things continue on into from episode
Serial
to episode?
I'm never listening to that. I've stopped listening to it.
Well, that's easy to do since there's no new episodes coming out
really?
For a long time.
Oh.
Oh, shout out to Summer. I want to shout out to Sarah Klein, who finally got her package.
Who's Summer?
Somebody at Yerba Buena who said hi and that they liked the show.
I didn't know that.
So shout out to Summer.
Hey, Summer.
I told her to say hi to you and I described you, but she didn't know what you look like. So maybe she was afraid to guess. Right. So hi, Summer. Shout out to Sarah Klein, who finally got her package and said very nice things about it. And shout out to everybody. Shout out to Mel Prest. Shout out to Oakland. Shout out to San Francisco. Shout out to Richmond. Shout out to the Albany Bulb.
Kate is on one, as she would say.
All right.
Congratulations. God, the fuck.
If that's too annoying, please write or text or bird in to 419-351-6606 to tell us how much you hate or love the singing of the congratulations.
And give us some ideas. We were thinking about doing another segment to the show.
Yeah, give us some segment ideas, but our imaginations were not on one.
They were on one.
I wish they were on one. Or you can send the bird messenger at Pine Tree Podcast. We love you. I hope you enjoyed the interview. I hope we have the interview.
We will. We're interviewing Stephen Wolf today.
Now they'll have listened to that interview because this is the end of the show.
Oh, right. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Stephen Wolf, one of the Bay's best gallerists. I'm excited to talk to him. I can't wait. I was so excited to talk to him. I just couldn't wait.
Have a good week, listeners. So I hope this Wednesday worked out for you.
Oh, yeah.
Because this is going up on Wednesday.